Right, welcome everyone. This is another in our Splitting Arrows series where we are chronologically looking at every single Robin Hood film we can possibly find. And we've dug up a special one this time. I have such a hard time talking about this movie because I never know what to call it. It's an Italian film from 1971. The Italian title is L'Arce di Fuoco, which literally translates to The Archer of Fire, except they didn't release it under that name. They released it under the name Long Live Robin Hood. But they also later released it, I think, on VHS in the US. And the title on the VHS was The Scalawag Bunch.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
This movie has multiple titles. Joining me to discuss this film is, of course, Rick, as ever, Richard Hopkins Lutz. And we have a couple of old friends joining us for our last episode, where we also did another Italian Robin Hood flick. We had my younger brother, Theo Papke. This time we have my younger sister, Marianne, aka Momo, who last joined us when we did The Son of Robin Hood.
Yes, hello.
And joining us again also is Jeff Wilkinson, one of our bad movie banditos.
This one's promising to definitely be up his particular bellowic, as it were.
How is everybody doing today?
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, good. So since my last appearance on the podcast, I've actually been doing a lot more reading about Robin Hood. So I'm much more familiar with the historical lore than I was last time. So I have a broader perspective and background now to going into this. Not that I have high expectations for rando Italian movie from the 70s. We'll see.
Yeah.
But I haven't, so my main inputs are still Disney and 90s Robin Hood movies.
Yeah, and at least the one Hammer film that you watched with us before.
Which was unexpectedly decent.
Yeah, and I'll actually say that Hammer film, which was The Men of Sherwood Forest, starring Don Taylor as Robin Hood, that has been one of the best Robin Hood movies that was a, we're doing something different with the character. It wasn't a, we're kind of telling you the story that you might expect to see, a Robin Hood trying to get his inheritance back kind of story or something like that. And I bring that up especially because with the last film, Robin Hood and the Pirates, I went into it expecting something really different. I was very excited because I was like, we're going to get Robin Hood on a boat. We're going to have him away from England. No, it was very much a bog standard, what you would expect to see as a Hollywood Robin Hood film, just with a lot of the names changed. It was very much the, I want Robin Hood. Oh, we have Robin Hood at home.
Yeah, no, that is accurate. It was, that movie was, it was disappointing on a lot of levels. Just really, like, it could have been really cool. And, like, there's a lot of places where, like, you could see some elements where if they developed it out a little bit more, it could have been better and everything. It just was such a disappointment. Whereas, like you said, Men of Sherwood Forest was kind of a sleeper. Like, I was really, went into that not expecting very much and came out of it definitely enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely what I watched.
Yeah, looking at the cast list for this film, this time I'm going into it expecting something much closer to the standard Hollywood story. We've got a lot of familiar names in there. There's Prince John, Guy of Gisborne, Will Scarlet, Little John. Let's say Marianne instead of Marion, but presumably this is going to be that same character. Now, since we're doing another Italian Robin Hood film, from the era of the Italian films that Rick, you last time referred to as being a bit on the schlocky side, with like the wonderful Hercules films being the perfect example. Jeff, you are more in the generation of me and Rick. Did you ever see any of those old weird Steve Reeves Hercules movies growing up?
No, very much not. My stuff was like the 90s Robin Hood, like the big blockbuster Robin Hood they did, I think, in the 90s. And Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah, you weren't catching all those weird Italian late night movies like Rick and I were, apparently.
No.
See, I was a big fan of late night cinema, and then I discovered MST3K, and I'm like, this is the greatest show that has ever existed.
Fantastic show.
Yeah, and yeah, so like I am very familiar with like those old like Steve Reeves. Not that I can recall plots or anything, not that they matter. They are schlock, and understand, listeners, I do not say that with any animus. I enjoy a good schlocky movie as much as anyone, because they can be super fun.
Yeah. Well, hopefully this one will be fun. And while Robin Hood and the Pirates was disappointing in a lot of ways, it still was pretty fun. There was a lot of good comedic moments and some at least reasonably passable swashbuckling. I'm hoping we can at least get that from this film as well. So for our cast and crew, our director was Giorgio Ferroni. This was one of his last films that he made. He had gotten his start in the 1930s, and he did make a lot of those sort of action films that we were just talking about, a lot of things that focused on Greco-Roman history and mythology, Trojans, warriors and Thebes, and so on. There's another kind of action movie that he did that I think my favorite title was Secret Agent Super Dragon.
I'd watch that.
Yeah, but he also has a bunch of other things in his filmography that seem to be romances. They seem to be tragedies. It looks like there was a breadth of things. He didn't just do the schlocky action stuff. There are three writers credited to the film. There's Ennio Di Concini, who has 165 writing credits.
Wow.
Yeah. There was Giorgio Stigiani, who seemed to especially work with Giorgio Ferroni, our director. I noticed that there was significant overlap on their writing and directing credits. They seemed to have been a bit of a team. And then Manuel Torres is also credited as a writer. He only has like a couple of writing credits. He seems to primarily have been a production manager as his career. Our star of the movie is Giuliano Gemma. He is listed as playing Sir Henry of Nottingham. So presumably Robin Hood will be an assumed name that he takes at some point during the film. We'll see. Now, Giuliano's nickname was Angel Face. And one of the interesting facts that I found about him is, though, even though he's known for having these angelic features and being an extremely handsome man, he had visible facial scars that were the result of a bomb exploding during World War II that he found as a child, and was like playing with this bomb, and it exploded. Clearly it didn't kill him or maim him terribly, but he did have scarring from it. He had an interesting background. He was an extremely athletic man. He had a career as a boxer and a gymnast and a tennis player. He also worked in a circus before getting his start in films as a stunt performer. And then later in life, he had a successful career as a sculptor as well. And he was continuing to act in films and television up until his death in an auto accident in 2013. I'm looking forward to seeing what he brings to this role. Some other fun things from his filmography, kind of what helped catapult him to stardom, were some of those spaghetti westerns being put out at the time. He was in three of them, playing the character Montgomery Wood. They were A Pistol for Ringo, Blood for a Silver Dollar, and The Return of Ringo. He was also in the movie Eric the Viking. Not the one with Tim Robbins from the 80s, but an Italian film called Eric the Viking that was made in the 60s. No relation to the book, because the book also was written later. Just a weird coincidence.
To be fair, if you're going to name a Viking, Eric is not a terrible pick.
Yeah.
I mean, given that there was a famous Viking named Eric.
Yes.
Yes, yes. And he did also do some of those Hercules movies that we were talking about. The best title I could find from any of the ones that he did was Hercules Against the Sons of the Sun.
Ooh.
In which...
Well, that one sounds terrible.
Yeah, it's Hercules fighting Incas, apparently.
Oh my God.
Oh, dear.
Like yeah. I said, those Hercules movies from the 60s, 50s, all that era, they're universally pretty terrible, and they stretched that concept, like Hercules against
X. I mean, I think that could have been interesting if it was like Acolytes of Helios.
Yes, that would be more interesting.
That's what I was assuming, it was going to be something like that, but nope, he's preventing an Incan ruler from performing human sacrifices. So it's like, probably going to be a little bit, what's the word? Massively insensitive.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, just a bit.
I mean, in the mythology, Hercules went to the New World
No, you're thinking of Mormonism. No, wait. That's
No. That's a different.
Anyway. The film also stars Mark Damon as a character listed as Alan. And I wonder if this is going to be a sort of take on Alan and Dale, but less as the minstrel type and more as an other sort of knightly warrior figure, which we saw before in the 1940s Prince of Thieves film, where there was this... Yeah, there was this Sir Alan who Robin Hood was helping out throughout that film. So I'm wondering if it might be something along those lines, perhaps borrowing a little bit from that material. And so some interesting things about Mark Damon. He is 90 years old and still working in Hollywood. Not as an actor, though. He actually only has a few acting credits. He's primarily been a producer and has... like a good half dozen projects right now that are in some stage of pre or post production. One of them is a upcoming musical comedy starring John Travolta and Christopher Walken called That's Amore. Probably one of the most famous films that he worked on and that he won awards for was Monster, the 2003 film with Charlize Theron.
Oh, I enjoyed that one.
Yeah. Well, Mark Damon was one of the producers for that. He also happens to be first cousins with Danny Elfman.
Okay.
Huh.
The famous film composer. Yep.
And lead singer of Oingo Boingo.
Yes.
But... all around kind of weird person.
Mm-hmm. But has some really memorable musical credits.
Oh, not dissing him. Elfman's a...
Yeah, I think Mark Damon's mother was... the sister of Danny Elfman's father or something like that. But yeah, first cousins.
No, Danny Elfman kind of revolutionized some movie soundtracks with what he brought. Everything. Very cool. Very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we also have in the film Luis Davila, who plays Sir Robert, who is an actor from Argentina. This is a very international cast, as we'll see. We have as our leading lady, Silvia Dionisio, who's playing Lady Marianne de Manson. She first started acting in films when she was 14, retired from acting in 1984. Her final acting credit is in a liquor commercial for Campari that was directed by Fellini.
Okay. That is amazing. I know it can't be a, you know, truly Fellini-esque, but I kind of want to find that commercial just to see.
Yeah.
Not that I'm the hugest like Fellini fan, but that is amazing. Sometimes I mean, every director does stuff. I mean,
yeah, we forget a lot that even those really lauded directors, they still need to make money sometimes.
Yep. Yep.
And then we have a Spanish actor, Manuel Zarzo, as our Will Scarlet. He has an impressive 245 acting credits to his name.
Wow. That's got to put him up there.
And I mentioned how Mark Damon at 90 years old is still out there producing things in Hollywood. Manuel Zarzo is still there in Italy acting as well. And in a couple of days from the time of this recording, we'll be celebrating his 92nd birthday.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's amazing to stay active in the industry that long.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we have Nello Pasafini, who is our Little John, an Italian actor. He was a bodyguard and a soccer player before getting into acting. Has 208 acting credits himself, so no slouch in that department either, and had an extensive list of stunt credits, in which it appears like he was basically doing his own stunts in a lot of the films.
You have to admire a working actor who, with that many, you know, even bit part credits, right? You know, just staying in, doing the work, producing. I don't want to call everything they do art, but you're just working. And those are the kind of actors they can bring a lot. Sometimes they don't. Who knows? I don't want to speak to the talent and effort of anyone, but.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, I'm looking forward to seeing, Nello Pasafini as our Little John. You know, I'm always looking for good takes on the various members of the Merry Men.
Exactly.
As far as some of our villains go, we also have Pierre Cressoy as Sir Guy of Gisborne, a French actor who was especially known for his good looks. And Daniele Dublino as our Prince John, another Italian actor. And then our last named character in the cast list is a German actress, Helga Lina, playing a character called Matilda. Helga was a dancer and a circus acrobat and a model before getting into acting herself, and has an extensive list of horror film credits. One of the better known of them is the film Horror Express that had Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing in it. But a lot of schlocky looking vampire films and things like that, a lot that very late night cinema, a lot of meant to be titillating and have not exactly pornographic elements, but tease the hint of them very in that very kind of late night movie kind of way.
Pays the bills.
Mm-hmm. Well, and she's actually on record saying that. Somebody asked her once about why she did all of these horror movies, and she's just like, I was a single mother and I was doing work.
I mean, people forget that Orson Welles did, you know, frozen pea commercials. And stuff. I mean, it pays the bills. And if you need the money, you need the money. And I'm not going to sit there and I was just talking about working actors. Like, no actor is so big that they don't, you know, that they can always turn down work. Yeah, well, they might make
a lot of money, but that's important to remember that it's really just a few. We often think of actors and we think of these movie stars who get millions of dollars for a film, but those are incredibly rare. There's only very, very few actors that actually make that kind of ridiculous amount of money.
Yeah, and a lot of us, you know, we'll have actors that we really enjoy, and they'll never make that much money, but, you know, we can enjoy them in parts. You know, think of what actress you even probably know from series that you like, movies that you like. They may not make a lot of money, but they bring a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The actors on your favorite television series quite often don't make excessive amounts of money. You'll get the occasional thing like Friends, where they're making like $1 million an episode or something like that. That's not shaming on them. I'm not. But a lot of them will make sometimes barely a living wage, especially if they're in California where things are very expensive.
Yeah. So
it's always keep remember that if you like an actor and everything in something, keep in mind that they're probably just a working actor. And it's part of the reason they do convention circuits, because
mm-hmm.
the convention circuits pay and everything. And
yep.
A lot of them do still love meeting their fans, love socializing, and love seeing how much it means to them. But, you know, got to remember, these are working people much of the time.
If an actor is charging $20, $40 for an autograph, it's not just because they're greedy. It's because they got bills.
They literally need the money.
And sometimes it's not even their choice. I've talked to actors at conventions where they're like, yeah, I would sign stuff for free, but my agent won't let me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's important to remember that they have those things like agents and managers, and they need them in order to get these gigs and roles in Hollywood. They're part of their overhead that we also often don't think of.
Yep.
All right. So I also wanted to just throw out that in addition to our normal list of questions that we'll go over after having watched the film, I'm going to throw out another one for each of you. And that's simply, what do you think is the best title for the movie? Should it be The Archer of Fire, Long Live Robin Hood, or The Scalawag Bunch?
I'm not gonna make any predictions as to what my answer will be, but I kind of love the title The Scalawag Bunch, just because scalawag is such a fun word to say.
It sounds like a Saturday morning cartoon or something.
It really does, like a 70s.
Like one. a 70s Saturday morning cartoon.
It actually always makes me think of the Apple Dumpling Gang.
As they saw their fame and fortune, their legend up and sprang, and they soon became the Apple Dumpling Gang. And they called them the Apple Dumpling Gang.
Yes, that was exactly kind of the thing I was thinking.
Yeah, it makes me think of cowboys more than anything.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah,
it doesn't bring Robin Hood to mind, as great a title as that is. But we'll see. Maybe they will just be a bunch of scalawags, and that will be the perfect title.
Maybe.
That would be a fun movie.
That would be a fun movie. Like, that's the thing. We haven't really had zany hijinks.
No.
And if this brings zany hijinks, that will be that will meet the criteria of doing something different.
I mean, we're literally going to get a film called The Zany Adventures of Robin Hood, but that's only when we get into the 1980s, and we're still plugging our way through the 1970s, because...
We can't, it just can't be truly zany, and because we got another, you know, almost 10 years to go until the 80s.
Although, don't forget a challenge for Robin Hood, which had some moments of genuine zaniness.
It did. The pie, was that the one that had the pie fight in it?
It sure is the one that had the pie fight.
And that was pretty zany.
And we also have covered the Disney animated Robin Hood, and that film is zany as all get out.
Yes.
But it's a family cartoon from Disney from the 1970s. Of course it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, zany. Yeah. So, I think you could qualify it as zany if you were just like picking an adjective that's not the one you would pick, though.
Yeah, I mean,
zany says to me more like a screwball comedy.
Yeah, yeah, same. I definitely has hijinks. Not gonna deny the hijinks.
Jinx, for sure.
But I don't know that I'd call it zany, because zany has like a certain pacing and a certain kind of like nonsensical absurdity to it, which that one doesn't have quite as much absurdity to it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's not very surreal in places.
I would say that that's actually accurate for some of the movie, because you do get like those moments like the Nod in Nottingham song, where you get the mouse with the little crumb being shared with him by the rabbit, and it's almost heartbreaking, and you get the intense fight with the with Friar Tuck and the sheriff. But then you also have like the whole sequence after the tournament, where the one group of guard rhinoceroses are charging around with a tent over them, and it's making locomotion sounds, and Lady Cluck has got her whole football tackling thing going on, and pies are flinging everywhere. Like, that is
That's one of the most zany things on film. Yeah, it has zany things, but it's not overall a zany movie. Partially because you do have those very low lows, right?
Yeah.
Most zany movies don't have a sine wave like that.
Right, and I feel like the challenge for Robin Hood is actually kind of similar, too, because there are moments where it is very serious, and, like, Robin is being really indignant about the plight of the poor, and there's a murder plot going on.
Yeah.
There's ways in which that film can be very serious, but then it also has, like, crazy pie fights and silly music, and, you know, you almost hear Benny Hill at one point.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, I know the movie that I would think of amongst the Robin Hood movies that I've seen, we haven't hit it yet, that I would actually consider zany on a real level. But Men in Tights is still quite a few films down the road for us.
I'm very curious to see how we compare George Segal's zany adventures of Robin Hood to Men in Tights. But we'll get there when we get there.
I do think that if you can put Benny Hill to it, that's a good qualifier to see if it's zany. And you're right, the fight after the tournament could definitely have had Benny Hill, and that would have worked.
Yeah, and there's a similar like montage Benny Hill-ish zany scene in A Challenge for Robin Hood, the one with Barry in them.
It has the best pie fight. Even better than the Disney Robin Hood one.
This is true. The best pie fight. I love Momo that you established a benchmark for zany. Well, you set Benny Hill music to it? If yes, zany. If no, then not.
it's very you.
All right. Does anybody else have any sort of expectations or thoughts about L'Archer de Fuoco before we get into it?
We'll be curious to see just how out of sync the lips are.
We do have a dubbed version that we're watching. Most of the Italian films being released at this time were dubbed, so I don't even know if a subtitled version is out there. These films mostly just exist in a dubbed form. And it is available on YouTube if anybody wants to find it. I think you can find it under any of those titles if you search for it on YouTube.
The one we are looking at has all three titles.
Exactly. So feel free to watch if you would like. We're going to pause our recording, watch the film ourselves, and then we will come back, share our thoughts, run through our list of questions.
I will say one note. They spell scallywag. They spell it scalawag, not scallywag, which is interesting. I wonder if that's an Italian thing, because scala is kind of a...
Well, and is that whoever put it up on YouTube, or was this how...
That's whoever put it up on YouTube. Yeah. I don't know if that is in the original...
VHS box or whatever it was that released it that way.
Who knows?
Yeah. All right. See you after the film, everybody.
See ya. Start the fire. No, we
didn't write it, but we tried to fight. What was the part that you said that's not how that works too?
To Tuck just declaring, like, no, I'm the ecclesiastic authority here. Right, Robin? And Robin, like, yeah, you are. Like, no, none of that.
But no, there's literally a bunch of priests right over there.
Even the king being like, you're the, you know, the bishop now is not how that works.
No, no. You're now Bishop Tuck. That's not how that works.
No, not remotely.
But he said it did, though.
Yeah, he said it did. And he had a stick.
That's true. He, yeah. He did. Okay. So, in Tuck's defense, this movie is all about that sword in the stone trope. So we have Robin proves himself as the true heir of Nottingham because he is the only one capable of pulling and firing the bow of Nottingham.
The weird-ass recurve bow that's definitely not an English longbow.
And King Richard is like proved to be King Richard because only he could have the sword that would cut through an ironwood staff like that.
It's iron cord.
And so therefore, by these kind of rules that the movie has set up, whoever wields the bishop's mitre must therefore be the bishop.
It is a metaphor for supreme executive power by divine right. I didn't vote for you.
So we are back from having watched the film with too many titles.
Although one stands out as fitting, I think. And I think called it.
Okay.
And I think one stands out as entirely unfitting.
Right.
Yes.
We'll get to that, though. So let's just start with our general impressions. Momo, did you enjoy this film?
I did enjoy this film. This was a pretty good, enjoyable film.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
It was. I went into it with pretty much no expectations and was pleasantly surprised about how enjoyable this film was. Good production quality. The costumes were
uneven.
Were uneven. Well, yeah, I don't know what was on John's head at that one point, but.
The costumes pretty well. They were colorful without being and you had distinctive nice colors, you know, and outfits for people, but they weren't glittery like you sometimes get.
Yeah. You had that really weird wavy thing.
That pseudo tie-dye thing going on.
So I would point out this is an Italian film. Italians fashion. Marion's outfit during the archery contest, it was a very like
fashionista Marion Archer. Yes.
Yeah. But overall, I thought this movie was well written.
Very 70s, too, in terms of that.
Yeah. Very 70s. But I thought the movie was well written. I thought the cinematography was pretty good. The acting was good. The fight choreography was much better than I expected it would be.
It had some damn good fight choreography.
Yeah.
Jeff, what did you think of the movie?
Yeah, I mean, it hit all the key Robin Hood points and threw in a couple extra bits that I really liked. I loved the bit of Friar Tuck sussing out the fake priests escorting the fake treasure load.
Yeah, that was definitely a high point. We'll need to discuss that one a little bit more.
There are a lot of high points in this movie.
Honestly. Yeah, but there were also some low points. We'll get to those because I don't want to build up this movie too much.
No.
Let's kind of run through some of our expectations for the various characters. So I mentioned that Sir Robert was Luis de Vila, is one of our actors, and that's our Sheriff of Nottingham. So he was our primary villain in the film. There was a Sir Guy, there was a Prince John. But this very much did the Sir Guy as the bumbling henchman of the sheriff. The sort of thing that we'll see again later with the Kevin Costner Prince of Thieves. This is one of the first times where we've actually really seen that trope being done. We'll see it again also with the Robin of Sherwood show in the 80s. But this might be the first time I can think of that has Sir Guy of Gisborne as bumbling henchman of Sheriff of Nottingham.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I like that. It was different because there were some things in this movie that really reminded me of like the 38 Robin Hood that you could tell they were inspired by in places, but that was not one of them. And so it was interesting to see, you know, he was Sir Robert first, Sheriff Nottingham second was his character, and to have Sir Guy is that kind of henchman instead. It was interesting, different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, different, but in that way that will become familiar.
Yeah, it was. It's that role reversal, that role flip, because in the 38, you know, the sheriff is kind of more the bumbling sidekick, and getting you Basil Rathbone is the guy of Gisborne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we even get the climactic sword fight at the end between Sir Robert and Robin, which is, again, very much them lifting from Errol Flynn, really trying to pull from that. And also a lot of callbacks to the Douglas Fairbanks Robin Hood.
Yes.
That's the one that this one really felt the most like in a lot of ways. Well,
and especially with how physical this Robin Hood was. This is one of mm-hmm. the most physical Robin Hoods that I remember seeing.
Mm-hmm.
In that final confrontation, it was really interesting. I commented to Momo that it's really obvious that one of those people has had stage fencing training and the other person either hasn't or isn't using it. and because one goes into a very classic fencing pose and the other one does not.
Yeah.
And some of that, I think, I'm wondering if that was intentional just due to the different natures of the two characters, because one is this very castle-bound noble and the other one has been living rough and ready first, apparently, you know, on the Crusades and then also, you know, back in the forest. I don't know, but it came across as kind of, here's these two different men with their two different fighting styles.
Yeah. Keeping on that topic of Sir Robert as our Sheriff of Nottingham, I thought he was a, perhaps not especially memorable, but perfectly serviceable primary villain.
Yeah.
Solid motivations. Yeah. He was a serviceable villain. Yeah, I agree. He didn't ham it up. He wasn't particularly like mustache twirling, which was actually mm-hmm. kind of nice.
Yeah. Our Prince John. We do need to talk about him, because that's one of our low points. And we have in the past mentioned how there has been a problematic level of gay coding for villains in these films, almost always Prince John, and it's happened repeatedly. There's like a shade of it that you can read in the Claude Rains performance in the 38 film. There's we could definitely see this with the Peter Ustinov cartoon lion from the Disney cartoon, but it's really strongly present in the non-animated Disney film, the one starring Richard Todd as Robin. That's a very gay-coded Prince John. And this may have surpassed that in terms of gay-coding Prince John, making him extremely effete and talking about picking up womanly skills and things at the beginning.
Your introduction to him is literally, oh, I'm better at womanly tasks than women are.
Yes, better at sewing.
Right, and he makes a comment about that's why, like, you shouldn't get married or, like...
Yes, you shouldn't marry a woman.
Specifically,
you shouldn't marry a woman. Well, and he goes into this whole thing about how, you know, his brother was always the rough and tumble one, so he was closer to his mother and everything. Like, I said to Momo, I'm like, could they gay code him harder? And then they did.
All his outfits were very feminized version of male clothing compared to the male
pastels,
costumes.
All of them pastels, except for when he was wearing that one black piece.
Yeah, and he only wore the black piece when it was the we're going to hang people, and he was all black.
Yeah. It was...
He had that flash of fuchsia.
Yeah, he had that flash of fuchsia. Genuinely, it is a problematic amount of gay coding.
Yeah, the limp-wristed handkerchief wave when it's time to drop the kid to be hung. Stuff like that.
I think that was Robert. Was that John or Robert?
No, that was John in all black on the throne.
Yes, but
I didn't remember John in that scene. I thought that had just...
I thought John was the one in all black sitting on the throne.
I think it was Robert.
No, John was absent for a chunk, and then he like came back later. Remember?
Yeah,
he was in an all black outfit.
That's when he was wearing black.
But it was like black with some very feminine color highlights. It was It was not a very masculine outfit.
Well, and not that characters need to be masculine, but if you're only having your villain be feminized, be gay coded, then that's where it's a problem.
Yeah.
Yes. And this is the John in this,
like, you could have just not had John in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, right. His only purpose was to, I guess, be gay coded and then, like, foil the sheriff's plans.
Well, it's part of the...
I don't know what you mean by foil the sheriff's plans.
The one woman who didn't want the sheriff to marry Marianne clearly, like, went to John and got him to override the sheriff.
I don't remember.
What was it? He was telling the... It was... She told him that they should go ahead and use the money to pay for the ransom, and the sheriff was against it, and then John comes down and is like, we're going to use the money to pay for the ransom.
Oh, okay. No, okay. I kind of remember that.
He was the mastermind of, like, the last ploy of the villains there.
Well, yeah. But he was basically in the movie the same way that Claude Rains as Prince John was, mostly just there at the beginning and there at the end to set up the idea that we're doing this treason against Richard. And
yeah,
the movie was better for the fact that he was out of it for most of it.
Yeah.
We wouldn't be ranking this movie much lower if he had had a larger role, but he was important for the plot.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, that he was included for that framing, and because it was part of the expected plot point from, like, the 38 film where they had that kind of setup.
Right, including the whole, we're going to end with the coronation piece.
Yeah.
Which is, again, straight... Oh, no, I guess they were ending with the wedding.
It was a marriage.
It was the marriage. But he was, like, there wearing his regal arraignment like he was going... like he was about to be coronated. It was kind of weird. And he was shouting about that he was the king.
Yeah, it is definitely one of the down points of that movie is that, that was a disappointment.
Yeah, the plot functions he served could have been, I don't know, done by courier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you could see why, even though it has a lot of the same story beats that the Kevin Costner Prince of Thieves film has also, you could see why they cut Prince John out of that movie.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
'cause it makes it easier to just focus on the sheriff being the villain instead.
You know, so we mentioned Guy of Gisborne as the bumbling henchman in this one, and there's not a lot more to say about him. He is just there as the named henchman and really nothing else. Whether you like that or not as an interpretation for that character, that's what it was. Didn't do it poorly. It's just what it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was totally fine because, I mean, like I said, I've been gaining more familiarity with the original ballads and stuff, and Guy wasn't originally a big character, so...
He has the one ballad, one of the original medieval ballads, so he's got pedigree there. You know, he's been associated with Robin Hood since the Middle Ages, but really only in one story, at least to start with.
Yeah, one story, and then he gets killed in that story. He's not a big character, and so it's fine to have him not be a main character.
And in that story, he's the henchman of the sheriff.
Yeah. No, it totally fits. Like, yeah.
So our other primary villain character, and this is a trope that we've been seeing a lot of. We saw it in the last movie, Robin Hood and the Pirates. We saw it the other time you were on, Momo, with the son of Robin Hood, where you have this other noble lady character. We saw it also in Wolf's Head recently too. So we've been seeing it like a lot recently in particular, where you have this other noble lady who's in cahoots with the villains, but isn't as fully bad as they are and ends up with some kind of weird tangled motivation that is often hard to interpret.
Yeah, I really was hoping for more from her in this movie. I like the one in Son of Robin Hood better.
Yeah. She was more fleshed out as a character.
Yeah, she had more clear actions, motivations, things that she did. And this, Matilda here.
She was wanting to marry the sheriff, Sir Robert, right?
That was her motivation. She was in love with Sir Robert, and so she was didn't want him to marry Marianne, and that was her character.
But then she was going to stab Robert before she herself got shot.
Well, because he was about to kill her.
Yeah.
She betrayed him, and he caught her. Like, she wasn't intending to be caught there, and she realized that she was. And so, at the end, her self-preservation was stronger than her love for him. That was fine. She was going to attack and kill him, but in the end, and then she just gets killed, and then that was the end.
And is never mentioned again.
Yep.
Well, to be fair, that's like 5 minutes before the end of the movie. So.
I was just expecting the self-preservation to kick in a different way that tied in with the personal motivations. Some kind of, but Robert, I was doing this for us.
Yeah, like I said, I didn't have a problem with that part because she was kind of established as being her own person. Like, she knows what she wants. She wants to marry the sheriff, and she's not weakened by that relationship. What you're saying, I feel like it would be weak of her to be like, oh, I'm doing it for us, but she's like, oh, you're gonna kill me? Well, I'm not gonna be killed. I'm gonna kill you instead. And so that I was fine with, but otherwise, because that was the full extent of her character, and I really wish that she was kind of more conniving and involved in the plot.
I mean, they do have her giving input on Robert's plans, on the sheriff's plans and everything. She's there, but like you, I kind of wanted a little bit more from her. Yeah. I thought the actress did a very, pretty good job, and would have liked to have seen
what she was given.
I would say the only performer that I had a issue with was our Prince John.
Watching him clearly reading cue cards or something over the head of Richard while he's talking with him, it's like you're not even looking at Richard while you're talking to him.
Yeah. Feel that the Marianne, she was a little flat.
Okay, yeah. No okay, I didn't
facial expressions.
That's true. I did not care for our Marianne either as an actress. She seemed just kind of very flat and unhappy all the time to the point where I was like, why is Robin attracted to this person? I don't understand this.
She was dead eyed. Like, her eyes were dead. Just like nothing. There was no.
Maybe. I don't know if. I want to say she's almost autistic coded. And so I actually didn't really have that much of a problem with it. And so, like, she keeps, like, this poker face. And she's hard to read. But, I don't know, I did get the sense that, she did have, like, some kind of hidden motivations. But she's trying very hard to hide it. Which, I don't know, especially autistic. But I don't know. Anyway.
That being said, I did think that this had a better love story between the two of them than a lot of these movies do.
I'm kind of on the fence with the love story. There were elements of it that I thought were great, elements that I thought were like just they didn't quite sell me on. I thought the idea behind it was great, though. So I'll give them at least points for that.
Yeah, the core idea that Marianne was already engaged to him at the age of 9, and so I just like, no, that's appropriate for that time period.
But and like, then she would just use that as an excuse, like whatever somebody was like kind of coming on to her, and she's like, no, go away.
Like, sorry, I'm already engaged.
Sorry, can't talk.
I'm engaged to the guy I haven't seen in 10 years.
And I liked that whole Robin knowing that he is the one to whom she is engaged, but consciously not taking advantage of that and being like, I'm impressed with this woman. I would like her to develop feelings for me, for who I am, not just because we were engaged when we were children.
And also being willing to poke fun at her a little bit about, oh, you're engaged to him, Mark. What does he look like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's tall and strong and, oh, so me?
Yeah, no, she had a good introduction. Like, yeah. So there were several scenes in this. There were a couple scenes in this where they kind of turned the tables on the original, on like the tropes of we see in the other movies and some of the originals. So, for instance, they have Much the Miller's son arrested for poaching, but it's Marion who comes up and tries to save him.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was really interesting. And her introduction involves shooting a hat off of somebody's head.
Mm-hmm. Our first beat of trick archery comes from Marion.
Yeah, and then later on, you have the archery contest happens, and Marion enters the archery contest and almost doesn't beat Robin, but almost beats him and matches him in a few shots. And so, like, I think that's part of the reason that, like, I kind of wanted just a slightly better actress in there, because they were doing a lot to mm-hmm. build out that character.
And yeah.
That was actually one of the more refreshing and nice things about this movie.
The DNA for a really good dynamic version of Marion was definitely there. I don't think it was fully realized, but it was definitely there, and there was a lot of really good aspects to it.
Yeah, there were a lot of good moments like that. And, you know, like in the 38 movie again, she's the one who's like, now I have a plan to save Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, after he's captured and about to be hanged, she's like, I'm the one who has got a plan to get him out of this. It's not a dynamic plan.
No, it's not like the best plan, but she is the one to speak up to have a plan when everyone else is sitting around moping like, oh no, this is the end. Robin's just going to die now. What can we do? So, you know, she's got a plan.
But I would point out that her plan, which is I'm going to go and offer myself in marriage to the sheriff in exchange for Robin's life, from a historical perspective, it's the leveraging of a noble woman's power. And so I understand where that plan comes from. I'm not saying I think it's a good plan. I'm saying that if you look at it from a, I'm a noble woman in Plantagenet in England, this is something that has power because I know that he wants it. I know that he wants my hand in marriage because he's told me to my effing face. And it's something that I can leverage for what I really want, which is to save Robin's life. And historically, yes, this is absolutely what marriages were used for.
Yeah, for bartering, power play,
political power.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for this Marion, it made sense that she wouldn't have thought of a action daring plan because it was established. You know, even though she's a really excellent archer, it's skill. Like, she's not like rough and tumble. She has.
Mm-hmm.
It's target practice is what she's good at.
Yeah. No, that's true.
Archery skills of a noble woman, and she's very into that noble woman persona.
Yeah, and specifically Saxon noble woman. Yeah. There's this whole thing around the archery contest of like, well, it's always been won by a Saxon. That's part of her stated motivation for entering is that she is a Saxon, so she will try to win it.
Right, and of course, historically speaking, the idea of like, oh, the Saxon nobles, not a thing by the reign of Richard the First. Just not. That's not there.
Yeah.
But whatever, it's also become a trope of Robin Hood things. The Saxon nobility is a huge part of Ivanhoe, and that's imprinted on everything since then.
Yeah.
Our other main characters were our merry men. And there's a couple who I thought were really stand out. I, in general, like the presentation of the Merry Men. There's a lot that kind of got lost in the shuffle. Like, I even texted at one point, like, which one of these guys is Will Scarlet? I've lost track. But in general, I liked Our Merry Men quite a lot.
Oh, yeah. I have no idea who Will Scarlet was in that. Like, I asked at one point who the guy with the lasso was, but that wasn't him. That was
Lightning Hands.
Lightning Hands.
Which I was
That's not one I've heard of before.
Yeah, no. Like, well, they introduced them all towards the beginning. And it's Will Scarlet, of course, is the one with the knives. Like, that's because it's always Will Scarlet with the knives.
Although, again, this might be the originator of that trope. I can't think of a moment before this where they have, like, Will Scarlet specializes in knives.
I know. It's interesting, but it is kind of one of these things, like...
He wasn't wearing red, though. That's what he was not wearing.
No.
Which is... kind of interesting, but yes. Then there's this other character, Lightning Hands, who has no other name, as far as we know.
But they only said it once, briefly.
Yes. Yes, Alan and Dale features very prominently.
Not a minstrel.
Not a minstrel, and Friar Tuck and Little John are other two big, developments. Friar Tuck especially. Friar Tuck gets an absolute truckload of screen time.
And since we've brought him up, I have to mention, he slipped past me somehow when I was looking up the cast members before. So I had to look him up while we were watching the movie because he had so much screen time. And that actor was Mario Adorf, who is a German actor. And we were before talking about how there were a lot of like working actors in this movie. He is one of them. He also... has over 200 films to his credit, and is another one who is in his 90s and is still active too, or at least was in up till 2021.
Wow.
Yeah.
Great. He was fantastic.
And has actually, you should look him up, Rick. You know, as you've mentioned many times, you have a special fondness for character actors. And he has a reputation for being one of the greatest character actors of European cinema of the 20th century.
I will absolutely look it up. It's fun because...
Yeah, he's not on the top cast.
He's not on the top cast of this movie. On IMDb. There he is. He's literally the last person listed before the rest of the cast alphabetically.
Oh my God. But he was... He was probably the member of the Merry Men that got the most screen time and the most development.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and run through our sort of list of questions here. Jeff, what is your pick for your favorite feat of archery from the film?
Sure. I'd probably go for, just because it's with that ridiculous recurve bow, shooting the weather vane.
Okay, yeah, using the bow of Nottingham.
The bow of Nottingham, which is in no way an English longbow, and it's just this bizarre recurve bow.
Which is the only bow that could shoot an arrow that far.
Yeah, it was an extra big, thick recurve that was wrapped a whole bunch of times.
A whole bunch of cords and stuff.
Cords or something.
That nobody else could pull except for Odysseus. I mean, the arrow.
Yeah, it definitely had that quality. I'm supposing it's probably supposed to be akin to like a Welsh war bow, which we've seen before as a thing, because that was in the Wolf's Head. You had the whole thing with the Welsh bow.
But yeah, it was a little silly.
It was very silly.
Because before Robin takes the bow, Sir Robert takes the bow, and it's just like, eh.
Yeah,
I'm not tired.
Momo, do you have a favorite feat of archery?
Yeah, I'm going to go with shooting the lever on the gate to make it close.
Yeah,
that was a good one.
They're escaping from Nottingham Castle at one point. Robin asks somebody to hand him his bow. He shoots the lever and it drops the portcullis down so they can make good their escape. That was my pick as well. I thought that was great.
There are some other good shots where they're like shooting ropes out of things. And
yeah,
and
there was one actually I will put in as a runner-up, which is they're in the camp and they're training these peasants to fight, and they're like lassoing this one guy, and he gets like a lasso around his neck, and Robin shoots the lasso off. So like that not frees him. He's just kind of being mischievous with a bow and arrow.
Yeah, the shooting the quarterstaff, expecting it to stick into it and shock Little John, and instead it's like, oh, it bounced right off. Why? Oh, the staff's got a core of iron in it.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, my pick was the lever. And the thing about that one I liked was I was expecting him to shoot the rope that was holding the portcullis up, and he didn't. He shot the lever.
Well, yeah. What was nice about it is it's not just a good shot. It's a clever shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep. So best bit of swashbuckling. Let's start with you this time, Momo.
Yeah, I would go with the first action fight right at the beginning, or, you know, towards the beginning, where it starts with Robin swinging over the chandelier. He hasn't even got a sword yet, but he gets one right away. And that whole fight where they're in the tavern and he's using benches to push people over in different places. Like, it was a good fight. He's doing like flips and...
Yeah. He does a backflip off of a table at one point, and you can tell that was our star, Giuliano Gemma, not a stuntman. That was the actor doing that backflip.
Yeah, that actor, he was young and athletic. Like, they show him with his shirt off a couple times. He's muscular.
Yeah, probably, like, this might be the most physical Robin since Douglas Fairbanks, honestly.
Which is saying something, because we had a few others that were not slouches, like Richard Todd and Errol Flynn. Those are very physical performances. But this guy outdoes them, which is impressive.
Errol Flynn doesn't do backflips.
No, he does a lot of, like, he'll do some running leaps and things. He does some impressive athletic feats, but this guy's got him popped.
Yeah.
Easily.
And I also was going to pick that first fight. Like, it starts with him swinging in on the chandelier and then just kind of continues on from there. He's fighting two guys. I did also like...
This is a tavern set piece, by the way. He's in his room in a tavern. And he hears
the Thai massage.
Yeah, getting a massage from the woman who works at the tavern, and hears this fight breaking out downstairs. Hears somebody saying how they're fighting for Sir Richard or for King Richard, and he just rows right in, swings from the chandelier, and dives into this fight to come to the aid of Alan there, who's fighting like half a dozen guards or so.
We don't know he's Alan up until that point. He is AliExpress Aragorn.
Yes. Very, very budget version of Aragorn guy in the tavern, but he's fighting like six guards by himself. And so Robin comes swinging in to help that one guy fighting the guards.
I'm still mostly amused in that scene. I was amused because I was the first chandelier swing. Was that the only chandelier swing in the entire movie?
It's the only chandelier swing, but there was a lot of swinging from trees.
But the thing that amused me the most is you hear someone shout, "For King Richard!" And they're sword fighting. And instead of grabbing his sword, he grabs his shirt.
Yes.
Right?
Like, he makes sure he puts his shirt on over his wet back and then goes swinging in and, like, has to steal a sword from somebody.
He doesn't want to catch a cold, Jeff. Jeez.
Yeah.
Well, so something I noted in the fights in this movie that I appreciated, it happened, like, three times where a fight starts, Robin hasn't got a sword, but he gets one right away, like, from someone else who has a sword. He fights someone, grabs their sword, and then he's got a sword. Like, it's never a handicap.
And that wasn't the only fight in which he did a flip or something, too. He was
a lot of acrobatics.
Yeah, exactly.
Understand, listeners, that if you have not watched this along with us, we are picking our favorite bit of swashbuckling. There was a menu to pick from. Of swashbuckling.
There's one point in the movie where, for no particular reason, he's up in a tree, swings down from the tree to land on his horse's saddle and rides off. Because how else would one mount a horse except by swinging onto it?
There is no other way. There's no. Well, I will say also, like, I did also like the fight towards the end where, you know, he's leaving the prison and the guards show up. He grabs a torch and sets people on fire, like, starts just wailing on guards, acquires a sword, strategically relocates a sword into his hand.
Yes.
And then, yeah, proceeds to, like, wail on people and only stops because the sheriff yanks a dagger and puts it to Marion's throat.
And the swashbuckling in action was good enough in this movie that the climactic fight between him and the sheriff was a huge letdown.
It was kind of boring.
It kind of dragged, yep.
It just wasn't exciting or dynamic. It wasn't as bad as some others that we have seen, because at least the guys could fight. It wasn't awful. It was just so uninspired compared to almost everything else we had seen before then.
Right. Well, because in all the other fights, you know, there was a lot going on. There were a lot of different people fighting, and this is just the two of them, and there's no banter, there's no music, so it's just the two of them fighting, and so, and that's all it was. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you can have a good dynamic duel between two people. That's kind of a hallmark of these films. They just didn't pull it off here.
Yeah.
What about the banter, though? As you mentioned, no good banter in that last fight. What was some of our contenders for wittiest bit of banter? I think, Rick, this time it's your turn to go first.
Oh, I think Momo and I are both in agreeance. Friar Tuck walking along with the fake priests, sussing them out with the Latin, but then using the Latin to warn the bandits via Much the Miller's son, who he had been teaching Latin earlier. That to me, because he's going back and forth with this priest, and he's praying, quote unquote, in Latin and watching for his reaction. And the priest's like, oh, yes, no, excellent, and everything. I really enjoyed that. I don't know that it counts as wittiest. It's my favorite bit of banter, but I don't know if it counts as wittiest. My personal favorite is actually related to this in that it was during the scene where he was teaching Much the Miller's son, and there's several great nice bits of banter, but I like when he holds up the rosary. He's like, what is this? And I don't know which bandit it is. It says, a string of beans. And I really liked that. It made me giggle. So wittiest, I would go for that, but best, I think, is actually the Latin bit.
That was certainly one of the probably the cleverest bit of writing and plotting in the movie, was that whole scene with the fake priests and Tuck sussing them out and then communicating to Much the Miller's son, which was that good callback to the lesson earlier. That was probably the best moment of writing in the movie.
Yeah, and of course, they didn't, like, translate the Latin for us, but you know he's speaking Latin, and it was a good bit of acting where you could tell what he was saying, even if you couldn't understand him, and like, you picked out the word where at one point he says, impostorum.
Yes. I really wanted him to say, normanes eunt domum.
I'm a little early for that.
Oh, I call Romans, Normans, they go to house. What?
Well, and I don't know if I was truly going to pick that for my favorite wittiest bit, but following that, there was a line he says where kind of the jig is up. You know, he's communicated his message. He says thank you in Latin because he heard, like, the bird signal from Much or the other merry men. And the fake priest is like, amen, blah, blah. And then Tuck says, now listen to the congregation's response.
That was good. I also liked in that particular scene how he clearly starts, like, even if you don't understand Latin, he's clearly doing a call and response bit of prayer where any priest who knows what he's doing would, when he stops, give the response to his call. And they're just like, oh, yes, very good. Very good.
Because apparently they've never been to church.
Right.
Jeff, was that your favorite bit of witty banter?
I really do like the bit at the end where he's like, now listen to the congregation. That was good. I also liked, as I mentioned earlier, when Robin is messing around with Marianne, trying to be like, oh, you're engaged, are you? What's he look like? And she's vaguely describing a handsome man. He's like, oh, so like me.
Yeah. My favorite was another Tuck line. My vote goes to, at the end of the archery tournament, Robin has won. He's not in disguise, but the sheriff has proclaimed that there would be no charges levied. They wouldn't try to capture anybody who has showed up to this tournament. And Robin Hood's only kind of a vague outlaw figure at this point. So he's not in disguise. He just wins the contest. And then the sheriff says, oh, arrest them. They're like, what? You broke your word. He's like, whatever, I don't care. And a big riot breaks out. They get the townspeople on their side. They defeat the sheriff's men. And this is important. Also, they're able to defeat the sheriff's men because most of them aren't there. They had tricked Sir Guy of Gisborne to lay an ambush somewhere else at that moment. That was another clever bit of writing, I thought. And an excuse, and also a good excuse for how they could get away with Robin not being in disguise at the archery contest. But they win, and they're making their escape, and Tuck takes the bag with the prize money and says, well, normally we steal from the rich, but this we won legitimately, and so I almost feel the bite of guilt in taking it.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I also liked in that same set of scenes, Robin sending a diss to Guy of Gisborne via letter delivered by an abbot. Yes. That was cold. That was just like, oh, you can go home again now. Like,
yeah.
Dude. Harsh. Just vicious.
Yeah, like there wasn't like a ton of witty dialogue in this movie. I wrote down one other thing where during the archery contest where it's just down to Robin and Marion there, and he's trying to flirt with her and she's just like, save your breath for when you shoot.
Yeah,
that was good.
Like, whatever,
probably her best line.
Yeah,
it, like you said, not a lot of witty banter, really. Not like, not a very witty movie, but a very playful and fun movie.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of playful and fun. I think Tuck had probably most of the best lines.
Yeah.
Little Don was, and God Robin.
God understands me when I speak in English.
English? No, he doesn't. He speaks Latin.
Yeah. Yeah, Robin and Little John were also very good at being playful in their speech, even if it wasn't especially witty. Mm-hmm. I think this segues well into the next question. And back to you for the answer, Jeff. Mm-hmm. Who would be your pick for the merriest man? This is the character that you would most want to select as a member of your outlaw band.
Definitely Tuck in this movie. He's skilled. He's one of the contestants for wittiest banter. His way of sussing out the fake priest was fantastic. His forethought to teach the youngest member of the party Latin so he could communicate with them without others understanding what he's saying was great.
Momo?
Yeah, Friar Tuck was my pick also. He's definitely got some of the most initiative also of all the of the Merry Men characters. So this movie had the trope of this was an established band of outlaws. Tuck was not the leader. Little John was. And overall, the characters besides Robin had this problem of not having a ton of initiative. Like, that's why they needed Robin to, like, be like, oh, much has been taken, so we need to go rescue him. That was all Robin. But of the Merry Men, I think Tuck had the most initiative, like, you know, towards the end, where he's just like, I'm going to designate myself as the bishop now.
Yeah. Did you have a different pick, Rick?
I'm going to pick Friar Tuck, but I want an honorable mention on Alan and Dale. Because I think Alan and Dale was a solid sidekick for parts of the movie, but not other parts. They meet in the tavern and they're old friends and everything, and then he just leaves him. He's like, yeah, we should totally do stuff together. What disappears? Yeah, like to the point where Robin, where at that point Henry comes out and asks the page, like, oh, where did my friend go? And the page is like, I don't know. He's like, I'll pay you. He's like, no, genuinely, I don't know. He just ghosts him, right? Leaves him on red. It was just like, whoa.
Like, so, we should go get coffee sometime. Bye.
Yeah, right. I did also like this little John, but I do feel like Friar Tuck, for all of his failings, and he has a few failings, Friar Tuck fits the criteria of who I would most want as a member of my outlaw gang.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have to agree. I think it's unanimous in this case. Friar Tuck was the only real standout there.
Somebody page Mike Nichols. He needs to watch this movie.
Now, for the last film, I had everybody just hold up their hands for their rating for How Rob Grew the Rich all together. And let's do that again. I'm going to count to three. And then everybody's going to hold up their fingers with a rating from 1 to 10 on How Robbed Were the Rich, with 1 being Robin and the Merry Men were completely ineffectual, 10 being they really not only like robbed from the rich, but they were champions of the people, really standing up for people, making their lives better. Where does this Robin fall on the scale as a champion of the people? All right. Does everybody have their ratings?
Mm-hmm.
All right. 1, 2, 3. Okay, so everybody voted something different, but it's a reasonable spread. From lowest to highest, Momo, you voted 2.
I did. So I voted so low because while they do a fair amount of gathering money, literally all of it is for Richard. Like, mm-hmm. It's all to, like, the whole reason Robin starts this band of outlaws and tries to start an uprising with the people is to raise money to free Richard. They need to raise £1 million and everything's for Richard. And
I love how they just say £1 million, like Dr. Evil from Austin Powers. We just need a big number of pounds, £1 million.
But I gave it a 2 instead of a 1 because he does inspire the people. There's a lot of peasant uprisings, which is cool. I'm not entirely clear that they were under any kind of duress before Robin started making trouble here. But even so, it was neat to see them all banding together under this common cause. They, you know, immediately abandoned Robin later in the movie when they thought that John was paying the ransom anyway. But I also didn't give it a 1 because there was a little bit of a nod. There was one mention of Robin being generous with money that was not just money for Richard, where the abbot or whoever it was at the church mentioned how Robin had given them some money, he was very kind or whatever.
Yeah.
Which that his only donation is to the church is not great, so it's still only a 2.
All right, Rick, you went up to a 3.
Much the same reasoning. There was the mention of him giving alms via the church, via the collection plate. He also does do some like things like unifying the. They're not really bandits. Like, that's one of the things that actually gets talked about, is that like the people in the forest, which they say number about 200, are not bandits per se. They're just people who are in the forest kind of dodging the law. They're outlaws. And he does kind of gather them up and he does train people. He's inspiring people. He's creating this kind of revolutionary force made of peasantry and everything. And he does inspire more than one riot in this movie. That's kind of about where I went with the the three. But he's obvious. He also, there's some moments where he, when he gets back at one point, he's like, oh, everybody have, you know, wine and food and everything like that. So he's obviously not pouring every penny into the ransom, just 98% of, you know, most of it. So that's why I went with the three. It's like Momo, it's kind of like, it's a notch up, in my case, two notches up, but not. I felt he was a champion of the underclass, but not the oppressed, because other than just increased taxes when John wants to make a show of paying the ransom, we don't really know how oppressed people truly are, other than just the normal level of, you're a medieval peasant. It sucks because nobles suck.
Okay, so I went one higher. I voted four, and I specifically did slightly higher because I did think they did a little bit more to showcase how oppressive this regime under the sheriff was. Because during the scene when Much is about to be hanged for poaching, and he is just a child. He is a child and is about to be hanged for poaching. Again, something we'll see very similar in the Kevin Costner Prince of Thieves down the road. But he's not the only one. There's a whole bunch of other people who are not members of the outlaw band, but had caused a lot of other minor infractions. Like, one of them was serving adulterated wine to the sheriff's men, and they were going to be hanged for that also. It was like a bunch of petty grievances that the sheriff found insulting for some reason, and he was going to hang them. And somebody made a comment, one of the bad guys, about how, this is going to be such a great place to live. Look at how we're getting rid of all of the dislikable, disreputable types. So kind of, I thought that was enough to showcase how oppressive they were as villains. And then coupled with the, like, we are going to lead riots, we are going to have this uprising. He does have an inspirational speech that was one of the, this is a solid nod to the Errol Flynn kind of rousing speech sort of moment. That was what elevated it up for me, but I still only gave it a 4 out of 10 because of the King Richard thing, because of how much that was the motivating factor to why we're stealing from the rich. So I quickly got to this point of, like, I don't think I can justify giving it above a 5, and it never even quite lifted to that level. So I went a little higher than both of you, but also kept it from going into the upper bracket for the same reason. Jeff, you only also went 2 of 5. You landed right in the middle.
Yeah, I went with a 5 because I felt it was kind of like neutral. He definitely succeeded at robbing from the rich, but as everyone pointed out, he wasn't robbing from the rich to give to the poor. He was robbing from the rich to build the ransom for King Richard. Yeah, he threw the money around to some of the poor people, and yeah, stuff sucked for them. But again, like 98% of what he was taking was for the ransom. So I gave it a 5 more because it was a neutral effect.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, he didn't fail to steal from the rich, but he didn't do good things with it. Basically, he stole from the rich to give to the rich.
This sainting of Richard trope, you've seen a lot of these. It gets tiresome.
Oh, yes. If only Richard was back, everything would be glorious. He's still a freaking monarch.
Yeah. And
you're still going to be dirt poor peasants.
And Richard, historically, didn't do that much for the peasantry.
No. Yeah, so I think this, you know, we're just segueing right into the next question, which is the low points. And one of the major low points is that it leans right into that mythologizing of King Richard.
But it takes it kind of, like we were talking about, takes it that next step level higher, because it's got this whole, like, Sword in the Stone, Excalibur.
Yeah, he's got magic king sword.
And it was just like, oh, it sliced through John's iron shod quarterstaff. It's just like, Okay. And literally, Little John stops and says, there's only one man who would wield a sword that could slice through that. And then everybody kneels, you know, it's just like, oh.
And I found that extremely amusing because the guy he's fighting before he takes off his helm and reveals his shield, it's like he's wearing a helm with a crown built into it.
Yeah.
Only kings do that. Only kings get to have crowns on their freaking helms.
So this definitely goes the farthest since the Douglas Fairbanks film in terms of mythologizing Richard, and does it in a way that is so weirdly similar to that movie. They have this exact same situation with Richard just randomly showing up in Sherwood Forest and going directly to the outlaw's hideout. And then just like arriving as this Black Knight, which is, again, a thing stolen from Ivanhoe. And then getting challenged by Friar Tuck and having a fight with Friar Tuck before they realize who he is. That's directly in the Fairbanks film. And then the super weird moment at the end when Robin is about to be killed and all of the archers from the sheriff's men are about to fire at him. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, the king jumps in front of Robin with his shield and deflects all the arrows. Also in the Douglas Fairbanks film.
So him showing up in Sherwood was not random, because Robin and a few of the Merry Men did successfully go infiltrate the castle and steal the £1 million to send to the ransom. He was led there directly by Alan A Dale. Alan A Dale was there with him.
He takes he opens his helmet and you see
I missed that Alan A Dale led him there. Okay. That does make more sense.
You miss it.
Yeah.
Blinking you miss.
Well, and part of the reason you miss it is because you know, you're used to, you're almost half expecting him to show up randomly because you're used to him doing that in other movies.
This is true.
And the timing felt so fast between Alan A Dale being able to go all the way to Germany to turn in that ransom and bring him back. Like that was felt really fast. I mean, so
it felt like it was the next day.
They kept Robin in prison for 6 months. You have to. That's just how you do it.
Right, but that was,
I'm just going to leave the room and assume everything goes to plan. That's...
Okay, okay. All right, I'll give it. I don't know, half a point for that.
Otherwise, like we said, we've already covered the problematic Prince John.
Yeah.
The flat-eyed Marion,
I could see what Momo was saying about the kind of autism coding, but it's hard to imagine that being intentionally done in 1971.
Yeah, autism wasn't defined the way that we define it now.
It was generally known by a very different word.
But, you know, I could definitely see it being coding for something else that might have been on the spectrum at that point.
Right, or not necessarily intentional coding, but that they were going for a character who just is stoic and hard to read.
Yeah.
Aloof.
Yeah, could be.
Aloof, yeah. I think aloof is probably a direction she had.
Yes, you are an aloof person who's historically difficult to read. So, I mean, overall, though, I don't think there were any real nadir points other than what we've covered. There were ups and downs in the movie. Overall, the writing was good. The dialogue was overall very good in most areas, serviceable in others. Mm-hmm. Never bad. I never got bad dialogue. There was some of the dialogue that was not as good as others, but never like cringe dialogue.
Right. Well, and this was also dubbed, the translation from Italian. So.
Well, it may never have been released in Italian.
If you look at if you do like the lip reading, they're saying the lines in English.
Most of them. John was saying a lot of his in Italian, I think, but a lot of the other actors were speaking.
He was one of the Italian actors, yeah.
But, like, overall, the movie was worth watching. Like, I don't regret having watched that for an hour and 45 minutes or whatever. I thought it was enjoyable Sunday afternoon movie.
I have a few low points that I think still really need to get mentioned. Jeff, did you have any others that jumped out at you?
No, I mean, we already covered them, especially like for me, almost a comical low point was the recurring kind of Sword and Stone stuff going on. You've got the Bow of Nottingham. That means he's the best. He's the greatest because he knew how to use it. And you've got King Arthur with, I've got the sword. Not King Arthur, King Richard with, I've got the sword and only King Richard could have this sword. And even just farcically at the end, oh, Friar Tuck's got the bishop's mitre. That means he's the bishop now.
And none of them were really especially plot relevant. It's not like these were MacGuffins that the film revolved around at any particular point. Momo, did you have any other low points that stood out to you?
No, I didn't have anything else noted.
I mean, there's probably going to be things you're probably going to mention that I'm almost certainly going to agree.
Right.
But overall, like I said, I'm thinking of like, we had some that were very low. And so I could be forgiving of minorly low points.
Well, I don't know if one of your low points is going to relate to the title you're dismissing, perhaps.
No, we'll get to titles in a moment.
I didn't want to spoil that, but it's not necessarily a low point. Anyway, go on then.
So this all kind of ties together. It's a kind of cascading series of low points. They include some good points in there too. So in this film, he is Sir Henry of Nottingham, returned from the Crusades to find that his home has been burned. Again, a thing we'll see again later in Prince of Thieves. Very weird.
Yeah, that was like weirdly prescient.
Prince of Thieves remake of this movie confirmed.
Right. They find this like guy sitting in the burned out remains. And for a moment, I was like, is this going to be the blind servant? That would be amazing. But no, he's just some guy. So, okay, his name's Henry instead of Robert or Robin or something like that. A little different. But, you know, that's fine. And then he takes up with these outlaws in the woods and decides he needs to use a pseudonym. And he picks the name Robin because it's the name of Much's dead brother. And That didn't sit well with
me. And I did comment on it at the time of, okay, that's weird.
Yeah.
A little creepy.
Yeah, like he's just met Much. Much had like mentioned his brother is dead. And Henry says, oh, what was his name? His name was Robin. Well, I'll be Robin now. And it's like, that's inappropriate.
Yeah.
And then he just says, I'm Robin Hood now. And why? Where does that come from? So the name, then he selects a pseudonym and becomes Robin Hood. That part I liked. How it was selected and the usurping of Much's dead brother's name, that did not sit well. Then, again, like, compliment sandwiching this thing, I really liked during the romance story with Marion, where one of the ways he kept teasing her and kind of like engaging with her was, oh, you're this noble woman and you're dismissive of me because I'm just some poor commoner. You know, his Robin Hood alias was this poor peasant outlaw living in the forest, and with him never revealing that he was actually noble born. And there was this attitude throughout it of, it shouldn't matter. What, I want her to love me for me. It was very much that Superman Clark Kent thing, where Clark Kent wants Lois to love him as Clark. I don't want her to love me because I'm a nobleman. I want her to love me because I'm a good guy and she likes me who I am as a person, and it shouldn't matter what my social class is. Except then at the end, it does.
Yep.
At the end of the movie,
very much matters.
King Richard says, who here objects to the marriage of Sir Robert, the sheriff, and the Lady Marian? And Robin Hood stands up and says, well, I do. And I challenge Sir Robert to a duel, because, you know, that's how you get women, by fighting other men. Sure. By compliment sandwiching this, I mostly meant inverse sandwich. Yeah. Like I said, I had some low points here. And the sheriff says, I can't duel this man. Duels are a matter between equals. And he's just some peasant. And then the king reveals, ah, but this is actually Sir Henry returned from the Crusades. He is a nobleman and a peer of the realm. Therefore, you can duel each other. So the idea that he was only legitimized as a suitor, legitimized as a person who could fight the sheriff because he happened to be of noble birth, that I felt really undercut the messaging from earlier in the movie. Mm-hmm. And along with then the duel actually not being a great duel, and the weird thing with King Richard jumping out and blocking all those arrows all at once, like that whole end of the movie did not work for me. There was a lot that I just did not like, but the worst part for me was that undercutting everything they had been saying before about how it doesn't matter what social class you're coming from. You're a person of value regardless of that. Oh no, it matters that he's noble after all.
I will say though that it didn't matter, at least to Marian. Like
this is true. She had admitted that she'd fallen in love with Robin Hood before she knew that he was actually Sir Henry returned.
Right. Yeah. And she didn't have anything to do with that or condoning that duel. I don't know if they even cut the camera to her. Like, I mean,
they did. They did at one point, mostly just to see kind of her beside Richard. She does get, you know, she kind of has no agency in that part. She at least has agency in saying no during the wedding.
She got to stand up and say no after hearing the call to know that Robin was going to get rescued.
Yeah. I want to point out a weird point. I don't know that it's a low point, but it's a weird point in that apparently the costumers, armors, whatever, do not understand how English shields work. Because they were wearing them lengthwise along their forearms,
right?
The pointed part over the hand, which means no sense. Okay, that's not okay. That's not how that works. Like I said, a weird point.
They wore them like they were giant bracers.
Yeah, or van braces or something. It was weird.
Yeah, I would also definitely agree that the way that Robin got his name was definitely a low point.
I'd forgotten about it because it was in the start of the movie.
Right. Yeah, and I didn't like write
it. Because it was much as like, well, here's my brother's clothes. He died, and then he's like, oh, I'll take your brother's name too, because I'm gonna wear his dead his clothes too.
Right. I agree. That was inappropriate. And where the heck did the hood come from? Like, you're not wearing a hood. You haven't worn a hood this whole. He doesn't wear a hood during the movie. Like, there's no.
To be fair, his hair was fabulous. So
it was.
The money maker.
He looked good. Angel Face was pulling it off.
Yeah.
It's true.
I did also, I know we're kind of almost transitioning into high points now. They pantsed Guy of Gisborne at one point.
Roped him up, pantsed him, and then sent him marching home with
which was funny.
His pants around his ankles.
Yeah. But no, yeah, I can agree with that low point with what you bring up there. Cause like, It does subvert the socialist message.
Right. And this will come up a little bit as we get to the final question that's specific to this movie about its title. Before we get to that, does anybody else have any just high points or other things that we've missed you want to mention? Mm-hmm. Jeff, do you have anything else?
I think we've hit all the things that I really liked about this movie.
Momo?
No, that's about it.
All right, Rick?
Unlike the last Italian film, had an actual forest.
Yes. I forgot to mention that earlier. This one was shot in Spain. In a few different locations.
Very Spanish castles.
Yeah, some Spanish castles, some actual forest land. A lot of it was very sparse-looking forest land, but some good proper trees for the Merry Men to be climbing up into and swinging out of.
And like I said, the costumery was high quality. I'm not going to argue anything towards historic accuracy. But I did like, so for instance, when they're being sent from presumably the Holy Roman Empire, they're wearing Holy Roman styled livery.
Yeah.
When Robin and the ambassador show up at the very beginning, before he becomes Robin.
Yeah, they've got the Imperial Eagle. They're wearing the appropriate colors and everything.
That was a fun little twist. It's Robin as Return Crusader, but also Robin is coming with the news about King Richard being abducted by the Holy Roman Emperor, by Henry VI. That's not something I'd seen before.
I had one other high point, just a nice little touch during the initial fight with Little John. You know, because you have to have a fight with Little John when you meet him for the first time. It didn't take place on a bridge to start or anything, but as they were fighting, they kind of backed onto like a little bridge over a stream. That's a nice touch.
Yeah,
which then resulted in Robin getting knocked into the water. Yeah, yeah. That was a pretty reasonable way to do that version of the scene.
The writers of this movie obviously had some familiarity with the previous movies, including the Douglas Fairbanks one.
Yeah.
There was just too much callback to that for them not to have had familiarity with that. And you obviously had an awareness of some of the, the materials, but did do some interesting twists on it. Now, I'm not going to say the ballads, but with the previous film materials.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the 38 and everything. There were some bicockets, though, again, Robin and his men, I don't think ever wore hats other than some monk's hoods at one point, although some of the hats on the extras were really questionable. Like some of those peasant hoods, I'm like, what is that thing on your head? But overall,
we're talking about hats.
It's true.
We gotta mention Prince John's furry crown.
His fur crown thing, it looked like an ermine had gone belly up and they just looped it around his head. It was weird.
Robin's outfit looked pretty good. A lot of the other costumes were just fine. I have like multiple times with Prince John, I was like, what is he wearing? This is the weirdest thing. I took screenshots of some of them. They are bizarre.
Yeah, they're truly strange.
Yeah, he needed his crown to match his ermine mantle.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, and if him more than anybody else, a little bit with Marion, a little bit with the sheriff, but mostly with Prince John, could you see that 1970s Italian fashion sensibilities coming through?
Yes.
Yeah, we mentioned Marion's outfit briefly earlier, but I did like it. It's like this nice, it's this cute yellow outfit with the little with the pants and tunic thing. It's practical yet fashionable.
Fur trim tunic a little bit, which made her look a little bit like she was fitting into that archer warrior vibe, but in like a kind of fashion runway sort of.
Yeah,
right. So it totally fit with her. I'm a noble woman, but I do archery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The first outfit they have her in is like this kind of take on the kind of huntsman Robin Hood outfit, where she's got like a bicocket. She's got these fabulous green sleeves and a brown jerkin. But then she has this like headscarf, which is very late 60s, early 70s Italian fashion and everything. Like, this is one of those movies that if you ever do a fashion of Robin Hood thing with like some of with some people I could name definitely be good for that, this would be one of those movies I would absolutely love to to have you do some stills or some clips of for them, because I think
you get a costumer to look at some of the things here. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, and when Marion was wearing that outfit you were just mentioning, that's when she does the trick shot that knocks her guy's hat off too, and she's rescuing Much the Miller's son.
Yeah, like some of the other fashion choices in this movie. Let's face it, the sheriff wearing that one weird psychedelic print.
Yeah.
Like it honestly, it looked like a magic eye.
It did.
To me.
Robin Hood's outfit is something that I wrote down on my list of things borrowed from the 38 film. Like that was very inspired by with the brown jerkin and green tights, brown boots.
Yeah, it was pretty basic, but very serviceable. It worked. All right. So the title of the film, L'Archer de Fuoco, Archer of Fire, which, okay-ish, you could make a case for it. Long Live Robin Hood and the Scalawag Bunch.
Scalawag Bunch wins it for me.
Scalawag Bunch all the way. The Archer of Fire. Yeah, there's two instances of fire being used in his plans, but only one of them involves archery, so...
Yeah, that happened one time.
Yeah.
You got to think about it metaphorically, man.
No, I won't. I'll deal with the fact that it is a bunch of scallywags.
Yeah, no, the prevailing theme of this movie was that it was a bunch of scallywags, because that's how we're introduced to the Merry Men. They coordinate together to steal Robin's stuff, and then he very mischievously gets them back.
Yeah.
And then it's a recurring theme with him and the Merry Men being
a bunch of troublemakers.
Exactly. And even, one of the things that I liked about, you've got your training montage, and Robin's just going around making mischief while they're training. And all the way through to the very end, where after Tuck's taken the bishop's staff, they're all still just playing around.
I mean, so, and even just the way his stuff is stolen, and that in his very first encounter with them, he finds a spot to take his apparently 3 p.m. nap, lays down with his pack for his pillow, his cloak over himself, his sword beside him, and his horse tied up, and wakes up to his horse gone, his sword gone, his cloak gone, his pack gone. He's just laying, still got his clothes on, but he's just laying there under a tree with nothing.
And he laughs about it. He thinks
laughs about it. It's like, oh, they got me.
And Long Live Robin Hood is inappropriate because in the movie, there is a line about, at the end of this, One of us will have to die, Robin Hood or Sir Henry. It's Robin Hood as the character, is the alias that dies, so he can't live long.
Yeah.
Right, so that's the other thing that I needed to bring up, and also correlates to what I was discussing with the low points. Long Live Robin Hood, when one of the kind of running themes is this dual identity, is he Sir Henry or is he Robin Hood, and he tells Marion that one of them will have to die before she knows that they're the same person. And then at the end, he declares that Robin Hood is dead. Now he is Sir Henry. And now he can marry Marion and reclaim his inheritance and all that. And so using that as the title is an extremely interesting choice. And I'm not saying that this is the title I would pick, but it does kind of, it's the title that makes me think. It's the title that makes me go, oh, but like, even though Robin Hood as a persona dies at the end of the movie, that is still the persona that we remember and who matters to us, and is the one that Marion fell in love with. So, in a way, that sentiment of Long Live Robin Hood feels appropriate. But perhaps that's like a too complicated and overthinking it sort of way to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard question, because Long Live Robin Hood is a better title for a Robin Hood movie than the Scalawag Bunch. Like I said, Scalawag Bunch makes me think of cowboys. This is, I would never have guessed if you just gave me that title that it was going to be a Robin Hood movie.
Yeah.
If it was the Scalawags of Sherwood.
There you go. That'd be a great title. Although they don't mention Sherwood at all.
So it's not
true. They don't. They're in the.
Maybe Long Live Robin Hood is a better title.
I'm just going to stick with Scalawag Bunch.
I think I've talked myself into Long Live Robin Hood because it has the most meaning behind it and also lets you know that it's a Robin Hood movie.
It's the most meta title.
If I want the movie to take itself seriously, Long Live Robin Hood. But I don't, so Scallywag Bunch.
This is fair. All right. Okay, so we've picked our titles. We've ranked how he is as a champion of the people, but how does he rank compared to other Robin Hoods from the previous films? And let me pull up.
I already had it up.
For once, you're the one that's prepared. All right. Now we have a full dozen Robin Hoods. Our Scalawag Bunch is going to give us a baker's dozen of Robins.
Yes.
At the very bottom of the list, we have our most recent entry, which was Lex Barker from our other Italian Robin Hood film, Robin Hood and the Pirates. At the very top of our list, we've got Brian Bedford, who voiced the animated Fox Robin Hood that everybody loves and just feels like the good, most distilled version. And I am really curious to get your thoughts on where we're going to place Giuliano Gemma here, because he really was channeling a lot of Errol Flynn. He was channeling a lot of Douglas Fairbanks. He also had some of the youthful energy that we saw with Richard Todd. He was incredibly athletic, incredibly energetic. He had a lot of charisma. He had a decent amount of indignation and some fervor behind him. You can say a lot of good things about this Robin. Momo and Jeff, would you agree just on that general principle that this was a good Robin Hood?
No, he was a very solid Robin. I mean, if I'm looking for a Robin that pulls off good plots and has some good banter and it does a lot of swinging from ropes and chandeliers and a bunch of acrobatics, yeah, he was solidly that.
Mm-hmm. And a good archer, you know, just...
Yeah, I mean, really the only downsides I see to him as a Robin Hood is there wasn't as much witty banter from him specifically. And, of course, the fact that his whole robbing from the rich wasn't to give the poor. Those are my only two detriments to him as far as being a solid Robin Hood.
So I think as Momo, did you have anything? Do you agree the general sentiment there?
Yeah, I generally agree. I do think that he didn't have as much natural leadership and charisma as I wanted him to be. Like, he got appointed leader, but it's kind of because he's the Robin Hood of this movie, so you expect him to be, and that's kind of the plot setup. But I didn't especially buy it. Not that he was bad or a bad leader or didn't have that fervor and making inspirational speeches and stuff, but I think he, I don't know how to phrase it exactly, but it wasn't the best.
So I think that for a Robin who is this level of energetic and acrobatic, and also this level of a King Richard loyalist, we need to start by comparing him to Douglas Fairbanks.
That was kind of where I was thinking, and...
which is putting him around the middle of the list, Douglas Fairbanks being 8 out of the 12.
Yes, and there's some things I definitely like better about this Robin than Douglas Fairbanks, but at the same time, there's the problematicness of he is essentially a Richard loyalist. That's his almost his entire motivation. There's no indignation about the treatment of the peasantry. Like, he's upset that Much is about to be hanged, but he's not, oh, this is terrible, and like
he does do a pretty decent rousing speech, and it is not just about like we need to preserve the land for Richard.
No, it's true, but like then throughout the rest of the movie, you know, there's not really any. This is why I gave him only a 3. because at least with Douglas Fairbanks, you see him at one point distributing wealth to the poor. It's a blink and you miss it scene, but it's there. And Errol Flynn, you see him feeding people. Like he's getting food and feeding people and everything. So I'm torn because I like a lot of things about this Robin Hood, but I feel like it missed some of the point on the robbing from the rich and giving to the poor part. I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Okay, so I definitely want to place him above Douglas Fairbanks. Like, the real problem with Douglas Fairbanks is he's Robin Hood for less than half of the movie. And while it was questionable how Giuliano there selected the name of Robin Hood, once he becomes Robin Hood, he is Robin Hood. And even before he selects the name, he is still basically being that character. He's swinging from the chandeliers to jump into the fight. He's tricking those members of the Merry Men who had stolen from him earlier. He's this clever, trickstery, fun-loving character. He's embodying the concept of Robin Hood even before he takes the name Robin Hood, whereas Douglas Fairbanks doesn't embody the concept of Robin Hood until over halfway through the film.
No, I definitely rate him above Fairbanks. For me, he's kind of duking it out in that 5, 6, 7 range. Because I don't think he beats out Don Taylor. Don Taylor was a better Robin Hood.
I think we need to put him above the Richard Green from Sword of Sherwood Forest. I think he is much more memorable, much more athletic, you know, much more dynamic. And I'm inclined to put him over Barry Ingham from A Challenge for Robin Hood 2. I liked him more as Robin Hood. For me, Richard Todd is being the main
point. That's kind of where I'm at, is that I don't know that he beats out Richard Todd. Because Richard Todd was a good Robin Hood. I think this one does beat him out for athleticism, but I feel like Richard Todd's Robin Hood was more a champion of the people and of the poor, and partially because he came from a yeoman background.
Yeah, and I think that is my sticking point too. There are aspects of Giuliano's performance as Robin that I like better than Richard Todd's performance as Robin. But when it comes to the character of Robin that they're embodying as a champion of the people, as this English folklore ballad character, I think Richard Todd has more of those elements. He feels more like, to Momo's point earlier, more like the one who is the actual leader of the Merry Men. He is actually from the yeoman class instead of just pretending to be for a little while. It kind of comes by his identity a little more honestly in this way.
Not slumming it.
Yeah. It's a hard one for me.
I think I would definitely put him below Richard Todd. He kind of dukes it out with Barry Ingram, but I think it would put him a notch above Barry Ingram.
I think he's a lot more memorable in the roles than Barry Ingram, a lot more dynamic.
Yeah. I'm comfortable with that ranking.
Yeah. All right. I think I am too. That means that Giuliano Gemma, the Robin Hood from the Scalawag Bunch, enters the list as the new number 6, directly below Richard Todd from 1952's Story of Robin Hood.
I'm comfortable with that because, yeah, like you said, he's more memorable than Barry Ingham, but Richard Todd, that was one, having never heard of that movie before we watched it, I was really surprised. Kind of like Don Taylor, kind of dark horse Robin Hood coming out of nowhere. And this one is, again, the same. A dark horse movie that I'd never heard of before you mentioned it. And just like, wow, this is better than expected. And the Robin Hood is better than expected. Mm-hmm. Kind of what we were hoping out of to happen with Lex Barker, but that just didn't materialize.
And to say, just because somebody's at the bottom of this list or bottom half of this list doesn't mean they're bad Robin Hoods. We don't have a bad Robin Hood on the list. Even at the bottom, Lex Barker, he was just kind of generic. He was bland. He was a little bit blah, but he wasn't bad. The word that you used before was inoffensive even, you know? So we don't have any bad Robins. So being in the middle of the list is still a good place to be.
I'm wondering if we'll get one. Like, I'm not, that's a genuine question. Like, I'm wondering if we'll get one. Not that I don't think.
Yes, I can guarantee.
I have not watched any of the recent ones, so I await the disappointment.
All right. And awaiting disappointment, what a great note to end on. This has been Splitting Arrows for L'Archer de Fuoco, a.k.a. Long Live Robin Hood, a.k.a. The Scalawag Bunch. This is a presentation from the Into the Greenwood podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can always go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/IntoGreenwood. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, all with the handle @IntoGreenwood, or email us at IntoGreenwood@gmail.com. If you'd like to get involved in any of our discussions, if you want to give us your thoughts about your favorite Robins or what you would title this movie, I would love to hear it. Our theme music is by Plastic 3. We could use a lot of support. This is a small podcast, very independently produced. Takes a while to do all the editing and get it out there. If you can't support us on buymeacoffee.com/IntoGreenwood, you could please, you know, maybe leave a rating, leave a review, share the podcast with your friends. It would be appreciated. Even just a little bit of word of mouth helps a lot. Thanks again, Rick. Thanks again, Momo. Thanks again, Jeff. Any closing words or thoughts?
Need more backflips in Robin Hood movies.
Yes.
That was good.
This one did set a high bar for backflips. It's true.
Yes.
Yeah. High bar that you could then backflip over.
Yes. All right.
I think we need Simone Biles to be the next Robin Hood.
Mm, Simone Biles as Robin Hood. Hashtag oh. Simone Biles Robin Hood.
Yep, I'd watch the hell out of that.
All right. Have a great night, guys. And thank you so much for joining us here in the Greenwood for another Splitting Arrows.
Bye. Feared by the bad, loved by the good, Robin Hood, Robin Hood.
Jen managed to walk in for a very brief moment, and she said of what she caught, she thinks he's a good Robin because he offered Marion a piece of cheese.
That is an excellent point.